Welcome, everyone. My name is Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Welcome to Against the Grain. Please do check out the rest of my podcasts, which can be found at the website samir3.podomatic.com. It can also be found on YouTube or Spotify by searching my first and last name. For those who are interested in contacting me regarding questions or for virtual appointments, my email is samir3@gmail.com. On Facebook, you can search Against the Grain to join the private group where there are ongoing discussions about these podcasts. There are many reasons why a whole food, plant-based diet may be helpful for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Data suggest limiting omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids in the form of oils, saturated fats, animal protein, and food additives may be associated with the reduced risk of developing IBD. A whole food plant-based diet seems to check all of those boxes. However, this doesn't change the fact that there are some out there who respond to the specific carbohydrate diet, which is a monosaccharide diet, that does not restrict meat, cheese, or cooking oils. Enthusiasm for a whole food plant-based diet is gaining steam, not just for IBD, but also other health conditions like heart disease, obesity, diabetes, and prevention of cancer. It's important to remember that there still is a lot of controversy regarding what is the optimal diet for human health if such a thing exists. Today, I interviewed Shamiz and Shukul Kachwala, who are brothers who run High Carb Health and promote a whole food plant-based diet. Shamiz has ulcerative colitis and has been maintaining drug-free remission with the whole food plant-based diet for over 7 years. As a disclaimer, this podcast should not be interpreted as medical advice and is not an official endorsement of this diet for the treatment of IBD, especially without appropriate medical therapy. But where are you guys located? Shukul, where are you?
I'm in Australia, in Melbourne.
Okay, and Shamiz, where are you?
I'm in Auckland, New Zealand.
Got it, okay.
So it's 9 a.m. where I am, and 7 a.m. where he is, yeah.
Okay, it's 2 p.m. here Chicago area, so.
I'm in Chicago. Oh, I love Chicago. I was there in 2014. Such a nice city.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's my hometown. So let's get started, because I know we have limited time. You guys are busy. So Shamiz,
how long have you got, Sham?
I have an hour.
Okay. I've got more than that. But, yeah, anyway.
More than an hour, yeah.
Okay. So can you briefly tell us about your ulcerative colitis diagnosis and how you were treated? I know that you have many videos on YouTube really going into it into detail, but if you can just briefly go over that for the listeners that are not familiar with your story.
So just specifically the treatment itself or my whole kind of hospital experience?
Yeah, the initial diagnosis and what happened in the hospital.
Right, okay, yeah, sure. So, yeah, I was diagnosed with mild colitis when I first got diagnosed. When I went to hospital, they did a sigmoidoscopy, and they found that I was, yeah, mild. I had inflammation in my rectum, and you know, they put me in the bed, hospital, in the ward, in the digestive ward or digestive health, colitis and Crohn's, people with digestive disease. They put me in that ward and said, "You're going to be here for about a week. We just want to observe you and see what happens with your condition. Here are some drugs that you need to take so that you can obviously get better." And I said, "Yep, that's fine." And, you know, I obviously had never, you know, been diagnosed with this condition at all, so I was kind of Googling it and seeing what this condition was about. I didn't know the name of what colitis was or anything. I'd never even heard of it before. It was a bit of a shock to me to think that I'd be needing to be here for about a week, you know, an observation. I mean, I trusted in the doctors a lot, and, you know, I just did exactly what they were saying. And so they put me on anti-inflammatory drugs. I think it was 5-ASA initially. I think they also put me on some antibiotics because they said that I had an infection. Basically, the first week, I was kind of going around 3 or 4 times to the bathroom when I first kind of got there. And I kind of asked the doctor, you know, what's going on? Like, how long am I going to be here for? And, you know, what's the state of my health? And he said, oh, you're not too bad. You know, you will stay here for a week and we'll reassess after that week to see how you're doing. And, yeah, my bowel movements kind of were pretty steady. Nothing generally crazy happened. But I think at the back end of the week, you know, things started to get a bit worse. And that's when, you know, they said, okay, well, you're going to have to stay a little bit longer than a week because your symptoms are getting worse. And, you know, they started me off with some food as well. And that was, you know, talking about diet, we're looking at like a half raw egg or half boiled egg. They gave me some fish. They gave me some rice porridge, miso soup. And also was drinking those Yakult. I don't know if anyone knows about that, the little yogurt drinks. They're quite famous in Asia, especially in Japan. And I was drinking quite a bit of those, thinking, you know, the good bacteria from yogurt should do me good. And I actually asked the doctor, you know, how many of these can I drink? And he's like, yeah, you can drink as many as you want. So I kind of may have gone overboard, but I was drinking probably around 2 or 3 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess just as the weeks sort of went by, my condition got worse and worse, and my bleeding started to get worse and worse. My frequency started getting more. My toilet trips, diarrhea was getting more and more. And I was kind of a bit shocked. I was taken back by it and going, you know, why am I getting worse? I, you know, kept asking the doctor, when am I going to get better? And he, you know, just said, well, you know, we're just going to see how the medications, you know, work on you. The medications should work. And that's what was happening. And I didn't see much improvement, you know, as the weeks went by. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, first week, you know, was kind of okay. And then the second week, I think things got worse. So I went from 3 to 4 times a day to 5 to 6, then 7 to 8, and sort of increased slowly. And then they started to kind of go, okay, well, we need to kind of put you on a higher dosage of medication. So then they brought in the steroids. They started with 20 mg. I can't remember the numbers specifically, but I think it was a lower dosage at the beginning, and then they started to increase that, and I ended up with 80 yeah. mg of steroids. It went to intravenous as well at one point because I was really not responding to tablets as well.
Mm-hmm.
But as the weeks went by, as the days went by, my symptoms just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I had to walk to the toilet. It was probably about 20 meters away from the room that I was in, where mm-hmm. there was, you know, about 5 others with me. And that was getting really tough because then I had to carry the drip, take it down with me to the toilet, and, you know, that wasn't very comfortable. And I did mess up a few times, you know, going back and forth. So that was quite annoying and you know, frustrating for myself. And so I asked for a private room, actually, and so we went into a private room, and, you know, the toilet was a lot closer, so it was a lot easier for me. So at that time, I think it was the third week, and that was when I kind of, you know, told my parents, hey, I think you're going to have to come and see me because I'm not getting any better. Doctors don't know what's wrong with me. They're giving me everything that they need to, and they're doing all the right things, but seems to me that I'm not responding to the medications.
So let me interrupt you right here because sure. You did send me your medical records, and I know a lot of questions online were like, oh, do you actually have ulcerative colitis? So I can certify, I looked at your records, you do. I didn't have the biopsy results, but definitely the inflammation in your colon was the way it looked. It was very suggestive of ulcerative colitis. And it was severe inflammation. I mean, I know initially it started mild, and they were only able to do a flex sig, just a partial scope. But eventually, when they did the whole scope, you did have deep ulcers in the colon, which is a marker of severe inflammation, what's called Mayo 3 inflammation, likely ulcerative colitis. They did see some inflammation in your ileum, which they thought was more what's called backwash ileitis, or just kind of the inflammation in the colon almost kind of spilling over into the ileum. And that can be consistent with ulcerative colitis as well, although I don't have the biopsies to confirm that. So there is an off chance it could be Crohn's or colitis with backwash. And from the records I saw, it looks like, yeah, you were put on mesalamine, steroids, which you weren't responding to, including IV steroids. You actually got worse with IV steroids. Then they actually tried leukocytopheresis, which is a very, you're one of the few people I know of that has actually had that treatment. It's very rare. It's definitely not used in the U.S. outside of clinical trials. And even the clinical trials that were done with that were, you know, years ago. And the trials were actually negative in the U.S., but they still use it in Japan and certain European countries because their data looks a little bit better.
But that's LCAP, isn't it? That's what LCAP means? Is that because that's what they told me?
Yes. Yep. Right. Yep. Where you had the IVs in, right, and your blood was being circulated through a machine.
I did that 11 times as well, and it was a very, very horrible experience because I was going around 30 or 40 times a day to the bathroom. So I was in nappies, and my mom was actually cleaning me on the hospital bed while I was, you know, getting this. It was horrible.
So just some background, because some of the people listening may be interested in this. That uses a machine that has these non-woven hollow fibers to actually trap your white blood cells as it's circulating through the machine. And the reason they think this will help, obviously, because we know immune cells, these leukocytes migrate to the colon when you're having colitis. So to kind of trap them, and it's almost like removing those from your blood, and also takes platelets out of the blood too. And so they've shown that this leads to reduced levels of these activated white blood cells. And then you do get new blood cells that replace those, and they tend to be less inflammatory, though. And there's also diminished migration of these white blood cells into the inflamed tissue and reduction of these pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha and others that results from this process. So again, Japanese trials say it may work, but U.S. trials say that it doesn't, so it's not really used in the U.S. So it seems like you were then transitioned to tacrolimus, and with this goal of you eventually just being on azathioprine. So tacrolimus as a short-term medication, anti-inflammatory medication, to bridge you to azathioprine is what I got from the records.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what they gave me in hospital, and I think that it didn't help me, that especially the LCAP. Like, I didn't see any improvement with that at all. The only thing that I saw improvement was the tacrolimus, which this was a drug that the senior GI doctor actually had to come in and say, well, if you don't want to do surgery, because at that time my colon was so severe that they actually, I did 4 colonoscopies right in hospital, and the third one was when he goes, well, I can't actually go further than your rectum because it's too inflamed. And that's when he said, we might have to do surgery and take a part of your colon out. And that's when, you know, my mother specifically said, you know, he's been in your care for the last 5 weeks. Like, what's going on? You know, and now he's wanting to take his, you know, you're wanting to cut a piece of his colon out. So luckily my mum obviously refused that. And she then found a book called Self-Healing Colitis and Crohn's online. And she was desperately trying to find some kind of alternative to this medication. And she typed in Google, you know, is tofu good for you? Because being in Japan, that's what we, you know, what we eat. And obviously, throughout this whole process, diet was never really mentioned to us. And, you know, they actually stopped feeding me because my symptoms were getting so bad. They wanted to see if the medication would work or, you know, be more effective. And I guess it didn't end up that way. So
that's actually that's something I've noticed certain as a treatment strategy, this whole thing about bowel rest or gut rest. And I know you were actually on TPN or nutrition through the IV, and they weren't giving you any food. I don't do that for ulcerative colitis. That doesn't really make sense to me, that strategy. It tends to work for Crohn's. When you stop eating, Crohn's disease, it tends to get better. But with ulcerative colitis, it doesn't. The inflammation still goes on. So I don't understand that decision. Unless they're trying to optimize your nutrition for eventually requiring surgery, maybe that was the rationale. Certainly, they'll put somebody on IV nutrition for a week or potentially a couple weeks before getting surgery. But overall, that whole concept of bowel rest doesn't tend to work for ulcerative colitis.
What was really interesting for us is that because we were in Japan, I think it was really hard to communicate with the doctors because they didn't really tell us what was going on. And why we're doing certain things. So that was a bit more challenging, to be honest. And I think it's interesting, being in a foreign country, potentially it may have helped us. I don't know. But we then, started to look at diets and tell them, look, So after taking tacrolimus, my bowel movements sort of went down from 40 times a day to around about, 10 to 15. I think it was. So that helped in some way. That got me going a little bit. And I think we, along with tacrolimus, we did talk to the doctors and we said, look, can we start refeeding? And we said, look, we talked to the nutritionist there and we said, look, can we just start eating these foods? Because, he's a foreigner, he's not responding to the foods that you initially gave him. So how about we try doing these things, and they didn't really have anything against what we, asked them for. It was just basically fruit and vegetables. The nutritionist did say, where are you going to get your protein from? And she said maybe have some, bread or some butter with that. Obviously, I didn't use the butter. Obviously that week went by. I started to see some rapid improvement in my bowels. My diarrhea started getting less. The bleeding also got less. And I actually got a lot of my energy back. Like, I wasn't able to walk, and I wasn't actually able to lift my arm up because I was just severely weak. And, it brings back a lot of memories, when I think about this. But I walked past the nurse's office, and they were looking at me going, how are you able to do this? So I think the dietary component worked really well for me, we were pretty happy with some of the results. And I actually stopped taking the tacrolimus, so they gave me, because it was an oral form, me being me, trying to research, because I had a little bit more energy, I started to kind of search on Google, what are these medications that they're giving me? And I looked into it, and the side effects were horrendous, and I got really scared. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I don't want to put this stuff in my body if it's, going to cause me more problems later on down the track. And so when they were giving it to me orally, I can't remember how many tablets I was taking, but when they started to give it to me orally, I actually told the nurse, because generally the nurse kind of stands there and sees you take it. And because I was very friendly with the nurses, I just said I'll take it later. And I don't recommend people do this, obviously. I was in a complete desperate situation, and I wanted to get out of the hospital. That was like my main goal, because I'd been here for 5.5 weeks, and it's not very nice to be in a place like that. So I was in a desperate state, so I wouldn't recommend anyone, do what I did, as, stop taking the medications without, proper professional advice. So I stopped taking those tacrolimus drugs. They also started to give me prednisone orally as well, so they removed the IV. And they were also giving me xylazine on top of that. So I actually stopped taking all of them. I weaned off the prednisone and the 5-ASA slowly. I guess it was just one of those things where every day I just started to take less. And, you know, I saw my body improve significantly, and I was like, wow, this is really exciting, because I can, you know, ask the doctor that can I go home now? Can I get discharged from hospital? And he said, all right, well, we'll do a colonoscopy and go from there. So he did do a colonoscopy, and he found that, you know, my colitis was in remission. He states that in that letter that I gave you, and he said, from now on, you know, Shamiz is going to have to take all these drugs. He gave me a suitcase full of drugs, actually, and I took it with me back home because I didn't want to cause any, you know, problems, and you know, I wanted to get out of the hospital as fast as I could to go back to New Zealand, because New Zealand, obviously being home, it's much more comfortable. You know, I can get much more rest and keep doing this diet and, you know, see my body and obviously get the nutrition that I needed, fruits and vegetables that I needed to get better, and the fiber specifically. So, you know, it was a pretty amazing experience for me, and life-changing one at that. And so, yeah, he discharged me, and yeah, there was lots of ups and downs, but, you know, we got there in the end. It took me around about 6 to 8 months to really find my feet and recover from this horrible condition that a lot of people suffer from.
Okay, yeah, I'm happy to hear you turned around a pretty dire situation facing surgery, and luckily, you know, responded to this diet. So, and we'll, you know, we'll talk about some of the more details of the sculpts a little bit later on. But so you eventually found, or your mother found, this book, Self-Healing Colitis and Crohn's by David Klein, which, yeah, I read that book years ago. And it seems like it's more from like a naturopathic type of interpretation of IBD, and it, you know, I did go over this in the review article I published on the various diets used for IBD. So why did you necessarily settle on that diet as opposed to these other diets that are out there? I just want to see, are you must be aware of the specific carbohydrate diet, the IBD-A diet. You know, even Dr. Chiba's, you know, semi-vegetarian, lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet. So what made you go for this? Was it just kind of like the first book you found, or did you actually investigate these other options and then after seeing them all, settle on this?
Yeah, so no, I didn't know anything. You know, my mum found this book. I didn't know what was going on at the time. And even after I got back to New Zealand, you know, I did do a little bit of research, but I didn't actually know about the SCD diet at all until obviously a little bit later.
They weren't easy to find, were they, Shane?
No, they weren't. My brother's actually here as well, by the way.
Yeah. They weren't really easy to find any kind of diet, to be honest, especially in 2012. I went to visit Shamiz in Japan and saw the kind of situation he was in. It was pretty bad. He was pretty thin. And really struggling to kind of get better. I visited him before he found the new lifestyle, and anytime you looked up ulcerative colitis, all you found was just it's an incurable condition. You've got to be on this medicine for life. Diet has nothing to do with it, and you couldn't really. It was very difficult to find anything about diet.
Especially in New Zealand as well. Like, it was just, no one was talking about it in New Zealand. No one was on YouTube talking about this either. And I guess, yeah, we settled on this book, and because we started to see results from doing this, what the book explained with you know, fruit and smoothies and doing a little bit of juicing and eating, you know, steamed vegetables, because it helped me a lot, I think that's where we trusted in it. And I started to get better and better as the days went on. So, I didn't actually know of any other diet at that time.
So what would you call the diet that you are promoting, that you are on now? Like, what, as far as terminology, are you calling it a whole food plant-based diet? Are you calling it vegan or high. I know your YouTube channel is High Carb Health. So, what do you call this diet?
We call it a whole food plant based diet.
Okay.
Yeah, we follow a whole food plant based diet. You know, vegan is an ideology, so we don't talk about vegan when it comes to diet, because you can have a very unhealthy vegan diet if you want to. So we focus on whole foods. The diet focuses, the program that we offer has three phases. There's a transition phase, there's a healing phase, and there's a post-healing phase. And the healing phase of the program lasts for not very long, but it mainly focuses on the healing diet principles in Dr. Klein's book. But the other two phases are mainly focused on a whole food plant-based diet, avoiding certain more difficult to digest foods such as gluten, things that are high in fat. So yeah, mainly, I don't know, Sham, if you want to add to that,
but yeah, mainly absolutely. A whole food plant-based diet. I think that while David Klein's book is there, I think we have learned a lot about my own experience of going through this, because this condition, or reversing this condition, is not only dietary related. There are so many other factors involved. We have five things that we generally talk about when it comes to, you know, reversing any kind of disease. It doesn't have to be IBD. It's food, obviously a plant-based diet, exercise, sleep, water, and stress. And those five things are pretty key in healing any kind of condition that you have. And I think it's an overall package that you have to look at, not just one thing only. And when you can really focus on all those aspects in your life, when you have them in check, then it's much easier to kind of see the results that you're looking for.
Yeah, and I mean, if people follow us on Instagram, they know we eat a lot of fruit, but we also eat the full spectrum of a whole food plant-based diet. So we eat lots of fruit, but we also eat whole grains, legumes, and different vegetables, and small amounts of nuts and seeds.
Okay. So, you know, so many protocols. You know, your YouTube channel is called High Carb Health, and that's actually what got my attention, because, you know, these YouTube algorithms, they kind of just spit out videos to you, and obviously, because I'm in my specialty is inflammatory bowel disease, I get a lot of these videos that pop up, and I saw yours and it said high carb, and that's usually not terminology you see with other dietary protocols for IBD. They tend to be either specific carb or low carb. But you're outwardly saying this is high carb, which makes some people nervous. But I think the distinction here is that there are different types of high carb diets, right? One that's full of processed food, like donuts and cupcakes, and, you know, not any real fiber there. And then there's high carb diets that come in the form of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and seeds that has the fiber going along with it, which I think is going to have a benefit in the gut.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, most people think of, when they think of carbs like donuts and cupcakes, those are actually very high fat foods. You know, they've got a lot of oil and fats in them. And if you actually look at the macronutrient composition, they'll be well into the 40 to 60% fat range. So, you know, a whole food plant-based diet, if you do it, as it's designed, it is actually a quite a high carb diet. You know, Dr. Colin Campbell wrote the China study, recommends about 80% of your calories come from carbohydrates, and 10% come from protein and fats, and that's kind of what we recommend as well. So that's why we chose High Carb Health. We wanted to make it really clear what we were about, and that the whole food plant-based diet is just naturally high in carbohydrates.
And also, I think just to add to that, when we first started off, you know, promoting this message about, you know, not only a plant-based diet, but a vegan lifestyle on top of that, the low-carb movement was quite big at the time, back in 2013, 2014. And I think we wanted to be a point of difference, and we wanted to be like, well, why are these guys suggesting this? It's like complete opposite. And so that's why we, you know, and it rings as well, you know, high-carb health, it sounds quite good. So it worked out pretty well for us to name ourselves that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of this low carb movement, you know, started with Atkins, and then with Gary Taubes, with this whole Good Calories, Bad Calories book, which I've read, and, you know, this whole theory that high carbs equals high insulin, and then insulin resistance, and then insulin is what turns, you know, gives you, makes you fat. So that's it's kind of like a simplistic explanation for it. But since then, there's a lot of controversy in this area. You'll see a lot of studies in support of a whole food plant-based diet, a lot of studies in support of low-fat diets, and then you have other studies that are do support a low-carb intervention. But there's a lot of shenanigans going on behind the scenes regarding who's funding these studies and if there's a conflict of interest and all this stuff. So I've come to the conclusion that you can pretty much cherry pick data to support any dietary theory, including this China study. You know, a lot of people have come out and saying, oh, you know, he cherry picked data from these certain countries and to fit, you know, whatever bias he had. So, I mean, you can come up with criticisms for really all of these studies. And in general, these dietary studies are not done in a very, reliable or high quality manner to make definitive conclusions. But I do think eating plant-based overall, the data seems to suggest that and that it's helpful. And then within the context of IBD, in that review article I published, there is data, at least in animal models and association studies, that potentially omega-6 fatty acids, and that's when we're talking about these vegetable oils, saturated fat, animal protein, and food additives may, like avoiding those things may be helpful in IBD. So the diet that you're recommending makes a lot of sense. And then when you look at diets like the SCD, which doesn't limit animal-derived foods like meat and cheese, in fact, the starter diet on the SCD is pretty much meat and cheese, you know, dry curd cottage cheese and, you know, broiled beef patty and, you know, like that type of stuff is the starter diet. And some people do respond to that. So it's a little bit confusing here, but at least theoretically your diet makes sense. And also the SCD doesn't make any stipulations about cooking oils. It pretty much says you can use, you know, whatever cooking oil you want. So, and then, you know, also increases in fiber from a large variety of plant sources. This should increase the biodiversity of the microbiome, help with gut barrier function, inhibit certain bacteria from becoming invasive and stimulating the immune system. So I do think that what you guys are doing makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's also a long-term approach. Like our approach is not we tell all of the clients who want to work with us, we're not here for quick fixes, and we're not here to try to try to get you into, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is that when you look at the evidence, right, where you look at things like heart health and blood sugar control and, you know, even research done on cancer, we know that this low-fat, whole food, plant-based diet is preventative for a lot of these conditions. So we don't want someone to maybe see some relief in their symptoms short-term on some of these kind of meat-heavy diets, only to have other problems later on as well. So we're trying to look at the kind of broad spectrum of evidence to try and work out what's best for our clients, not only in the short term, but also in the long term.
And go ahead.
Sorry, and also, you know, we're looking at the environment too, your carbon footprint and your ethical stance as well. Now, I know that has nothing to do with health, but it definitely has a impact on lifestyle. And I think we want to promote a diet that is going to be beneficial for everything, you know. And
sustainable.
And sustainable, yeah. Mm.
And what was your diet prior to the diagnosis of ulcerative colitis? Was it a vast departure from the way you're eating now? Or were you... Because I do see patients that say that, oh, you know, they get diagnosed and they're already vegetarian and they're, you know, already eating somewhat plant-based, but most of them tend to be still eating dairy or processed foods, but they're still vegetarian. But what was your dietary pattern before you were diagnosed?
Yeah, so from a young age, I absolutely loved milk. I was drinking about 4 glasses a day when I was a kid. And then when I started to, you know, grow up as a teenager, I used to have a lot of, I mean, we moved to New Zealand, right? So there's a lot of dairy in this country. And, breakfast, cheese, breakfast with milk, obviously, and cereal. lots of cheese, and you know, none of it was a concern for me because at that time, you know, I was somewhat healthy. I didn't think of anything, didn't even look at diet at all, and just ate whatever I wanted. I think back end of my stay in Japan, you know, going into winter and being in a very cold climate, it wasn't very easy for me to have access to, you know, cooking my own food because my house was not very well insulated and it was freezing inside. And so I didn't really have a good kitchen to cook my own food. So I wasn't eating McDonald's or anything like that. I was going to places which, you know, used to cook up a nice meal for me and I used to take it home. And I didn't really pay attention to my diet at all. I did used to go to the gym a lot. I never was really into the protein shakes or anything like that. But I ate anything. You know, I actually was going to a lot of the sushi bars and eating a lot of salmon, actually, at the time, and tuna, because I thought it was very healthy for you, the omegas. So that was something that I used to do not a daily basis, but quite often I used to go to a sushi bar and eat the, you know, raw fish, and potentially that could have been another reason to get issues in the first place, because we know how toxic fish is these days, and you know, maybe that had something to do with it as well, of getting some kind of gut issue. But no attention to diet whatsoever. Ate what I wanted. Never even considered, you know, doing any different diet.
We never considered diet as, you know, I mean, we thought we ate healthy. You know, we would eat meat every day, dairy, lots of cheese. You know, we'd have salads and stuff, and we would eat, you know, because we're Indian, we'd also eat legumes and grains and those kind of things. But yeah, it was quite a
meat and dairy heavy diet.
Meat and dairy, yeah.
Okay.
All sorts of food, New Zealand. All different types of food.
Got it. Okay. So now I really want to drill into the actual dietary protocol in the last 30 minutes or so that we have. So, you know, can you go over the protocol as far as the phases? Like, let's say you have somebody who's very sick in the hospital, like you were in Japan. How do you start this diet?
Okay. So, first of all, if they're in the hospital, we suggest for them to get stabilized, follow the doctor's advice, and try to get home, and just try to eat whatever they can get that's plant-based, okay? And so it's basically, once they get home, the first phase is what we call a transition phase, and it's a whole food plant-based diet. Starts off in the morning with a smoothie with bananas as your base, but you can add different fruits to that to add to flavor. So the first thing in the morning is always a smoothie. And then for lunch and dinner, you're eating a whole food plant-based diet that's focused mainly on what we call the softer starches. So tuber-type vegetables, potatoes, sweet potatoes, pumpkins, squashes, but also small amounts of grains and other vegetables that they can consume without causing too much difficulty to them. We ask people to avoid gluten. We ask people to avoid salads, like raw, crunchy type vegetables. We ask people to avoid any kind of overt fats apart from a small amount of avocado. And we also ask people to avoid nuts and seeds.
And alcohol as well.
Yeah, obviously alcohol. Yeah. So the basic transition diet involves quite a bit of variety. They can use small amounts of herbs, spices, you know, and garlic, those kind of things. And it's just to get them started off understanding how to live with a plant-based diet. Mm-hmm. So it's really, while we're getting to know our client, not putting them in a situation that can kind of cause any kind of increase in symptoms too rapidly.
And also not put them off as well, because, yeah. I mean, you know, when you go on to a very simple diet, it can get very hard mentally to stick to something like that, and and that's where the transition diet comes in, to give them some relief initially if they are struggling with their symptoms, and slowly introduce these different fibers, predominantly starch based.
It is trying to kind of increase the amount of fiber slowly into their diet. It's not like let's go from zero to hero, because that can cause a shock to the gut. So we
tend to avoid beans and rice as well. More tubers.
Minimize that. Yeah, we really minimize that at the beginning.
Okay. And how do you recommend people cook these things? Because if you're saying avoid oils, so is this mainly steaming these vegetables and tubers?
Baking as well.
So you can either steam, boil, bake. We have a video on our channel that shows how to stir fry without oil. So it is possible, and we cook all sorts of different foods without oil. You don't need to use oil to cook food. It's a heavily processed food, so we don't really recommend it. 100% fat, devoid of a lot of the nutrition of the whole food. So we try to recommend people avoid heavily processed foods as much as possible. The oil is out, but basically it's steaming, boiling, baking, and using the no oil method of stir frying.
So we have a saying: steam, bake, or boil, just without oil.
Okay. Yeah. What about air frying? Are you guys? I mean, there's no oil with that, so.
Yeah, air frying is similar to baking. Yeah. Or using the oven, but it's just a small oven. Absolutely, I love the air fryer.
Yeah, I think you use it every day, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
Okay, and you mentioned with this starter diet that certain whole grains. Like, what are the grains that are okay to start with in somebody who's really symptomatic, inflamed?
Yeah, it really depends. So a lot of the stuff you're talking about, we personalize the program specifically to each person as we get to know them and understand how their symptoms work. So I don't think there's a way to say that one person may be okay with one sort of grain while another person may not be. I guess the only way to know it is if you try it, right? But generally what people seem to do okay with, brown rice, people seem to do okay with. People seem to do okay with millets. So most of the softer gluten-free grains seem to be okay initially during the transition phase, but some people may not do okay with them, in which case we'll say, look, it's causing you discomfort or you're not feeling good with it, then you better avoid it and eat something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not to say that, when people go on the transition phase, they don't need to go on a healing phase either. This is also a healing phase too. It's just not as restricted, because some people's condition can be quite severe, and so the more simple foods can actually benefit sometimes some people more than having more variety. So having a simpler diet can actually ease pain, irritation a lot more, and so we find that that's what happens when they simplify, when they eat blended vegetables, pureed vegetables. So when you don't have to chew as much as well, therefore it just eases your digestion, especially if you are inflamed. These foods can help with symptoms.
That's a really good point, because if someone's really, really severe, they may not be able to handle a lot of food. They may be feeling quite nauseous. So sometimes it's just better to eat really soft, simple foods till you can have a bit more of an appetite and you're feeling a little bit better. And then you can add more variety at that point.
Have you encountered issues with people losing a lot of weight with this, transition diet? Because you're taking out meat, oils, and most grains, it seems like, initially. So people are left with fruits, vegetables, mainly. I think that's where more traditionally trained, like MDs, GI doctors, get a little bit nervous about restricting this diet. Because I do think this transition diet that is in David Klein's book and what you guys are doing is probably the most restrictive that I've seen, even more restrictive than the specific carbohydrate diet when it comes to like things you should avoid in the beginning. So that's where I think people get a little bit nervous about this. But obviously, you've guided people through this before. So what has been your experience?
It's a good question. I just make it clear that the transition diet's not based on Dr. Klein's work. That's based on our own experience.
Okay.
And it's a lot more varied than what Dr. Klein would recommend. So the transition diet, actually people don't, they do lose weight. I mean, it's not necessarily the diet that I've had people lose weight eating 3,000, 3,500 calories a day. Because when you're going to the bathroom as often as people do, it's hard to keep the weight on. And we also find that generally the body's in a state of catabolism when you're doing a healing process. So putting on weight is difficult. So I think you're right. Most people do lose weight, and we're quite used to that happening. But what we've found is we try and keep it at a safe level, and we try to monitor with blood tests and things like that. And we don't like to take a huge amount of risk with our clients. So we don't like to see people lose tremendous amounts of weight. And if they do, then there needs to be some form of intervention. It's generally because of the inflammation. You know, if the inflammation is there and the symptoms are there, then weight loss is, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've seen patients even eating meat heavy diets who come into the hospital very underweight because of their symptoms. So
right.
Even though the diet may be more restrictive than what most people think of, when you've got symptoms, I don't think it matters what you eat. You're going to, I don't know if you agree, Sam, but you're going to lose weight if you've got symptoms of you.
Well, I think also people are coming from a flare up, and when they're in a flare up, I think they are already losing weight. And so is it about adjusting the food that they eat to, you know, allow the symptoms to get better? Because you can still lose weight and your symptoms can improve as well on top of that. So I think, yeah, also when someone does lose a lot of weight, we do put them on things like Kate Farms. Okay. Yeah. So that's that nutritional drink that is, you know, without whey or dairy, and that can work quite well with people that are underweight and they need that nutrition. So Kate Farms is something that we would recommend our clients go and get if they can't absorb these fibers from blended foods. So that's another option.
Yeah, absorb the fibers.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. And so what we find, though, Samir, is that as people get better and their symptoms improve, they just put on weight effortlessly. It happens every single time. So if someone gets better and the symptoms improve and the inflammation starts to come down, the weight, you know, they don't need to necessarily change what they're eating, and the weight just starts to increase without them actually even trying to do anything. It's quite an amazing thing to see.
Yeah, the grain question is an important one, because just comparing and contrasting your protocol with other protocols, the specific carbohydrate diet eliminates all grains, and the IBDA diet allows certain grains like steel-cut oatmeal and some others. The Briggs protocol, I'm not sure if you've heard of that, which encourages gluten-free grains, which is, I believe, what you're kind of in agreement with. And then, you know, newer protocols, like there's this book that's been published recently, Fiber Fueled, which is not an IBD-specific book. It's kind of for general health, and it's also promoting this plant-based diet. It seems like all unprocessed grains are encouraged, but even ones that do contain gluten, because there's they make the argument there's a lot of misinformation about gluten being harmful in people. But he makes the argument that gluten-containing grains can actually help with intestinal barrier function and things like that. So eventually, you know, when somebody heals on this diet and is in remission and doing well, what specific grains are allowed on your diet within the context of these other diets? Like, where are you in agreement?
Yeah, so, you know, the evidence shows that whole grains are anti-inflammatory. So I kind of do agree a lot with what Dr. B is talking about in Fiber Field, but generally when the bowel's inflamed, some of these grains can be a bit too harsh for the body to handle that. So even sometimes, you know, people might not be able to handle brown rice because they get pain when they eat it. So I think, you know, you got to look at the evidence, but you also got to look at the client and how they're feeling with certain foods and adjust the recommendations based on what they're telling you. So, but once someone heals and they get better, we don't discourage. We say all whole grains are fine.
Okay.
Yeah, and also, if someone doesn't do well with certain types of grains, they don't have to eat them.
That's true.
You know, it's not. I mean, once you hear your gut, you want to make sure that you eat foods that you're happy with, and you can eat a whole spectrum, but you don't have to eat them every single day.
Correct.
It just depends on how you feel and what we basically do is give you a foundation or a base, and then you basically then take from the information that we've given you and what you've learnt from us, you know, make a beautiful balance for yourself. And what works for you, someone that has a severe condition that is healed, you know, may not be able to eat certain foods as someone that has had a minor or a condition that's not as bad. And that's where you have to work around for yourself. So that's what we would recommend as well.
Yeah, and most people are definitely able to eat all the whole grains. You know, some people try to minimize gluten. Like, you know, we don't try to eat gluten every single day, but we don't have any trouble digesting it. Shamiz, I don't think you have any trouble digesting it, do you?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you a few examples, and you tell me what you think about these, like quinoa, red lentil pasta, whole wheat pasta. Any issues with those, or if somebody's fine, they should be able to tolerate that?
Yeah, if someone's fine, they shouldn't have any problems.
And what about whole, like, grains that are like white flour pasta or white bread? Is that something that can occasionally be eaten, or is that not allowed?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the person. I mean, if they want to eat that and they see that their body doesn't feel as good with that kind of food, then hold off on that or eat the whole grain version of it.
You see, Samir, our program is not prescriptive. Okay, we give people advice and guidance around what the best situation is based on what, you know, the evidence tells us and what we've learned from it. But, you know, does Shamiz sometimes eat bread, white bread? Like, he'll go and have a pizza sometimes? Yeah. Does he do it every week? No. But it's something that, you know, it gives you a bit of flexibility to be able to kind of live in society. And that's the whole idea is, once in a while, if you do something that's not optimal, will your digestion be able to handle that? The answer is, for the vast majority of our clients, yes. But should they do that all the time and eat like semi-processed grains and things like that? We don't recommend doing that on a regular basis.
Okay. And what about the question about raw fruits and vegetables versus cooked? Is there a preference? Is there something that, is there like a proportion that you should aim for?
In my experience, I do like raw foods. I think they give you the best bang for your buck. I feel absolutely amazing on raw fruits and vegetables, but I do love my cooked vegetables as well. And and that's where that I'm striking a perfect balance with myself and with my performance, with my athletic performance, with my muscle recovery. All these, you know, foods enhance that. And so I have basically, you know, in 8 years, you know, made a really nice, I guess, portfolio for myself to which foods I really work really well with me and benefits me with my athletic performance and running marathons and half marathons and mountain bike races and things like that. So I want to optimize my gut to be the best it can be, and I've found a really good balance for myself. And that's what I want to teach other people and be like, hey, maybe if you do this, then you can also find that balance for yourself.
But just to add to that, Sham, when someone's got an inflamed gut, certain raw vegetables may not be advisable. But we, you know, all the soft kind of fruits, bananas, dates, papayas, mangoes, blueberries, people tend to do pretty well on those kind of melons. People do pretty well on those kind of foods when they've got inflammation in the gut. And people do pretty well when they have smoothies as well, when their gut is inflamed and ulcerated, kind of tends to be softer. We try and focus on soluble fibers mostly, foods that have a lot of soluble fiber when the gut's inflamed, because that's the food that has, you know, substances like pectin and guar in there that are kind of softer, and they don't seem to cause as much disturbance to the gut lining as the food passes through.
Okay. And what do you say about sweeteners? On the SCD, honey is allowed, but sucrose or table sugar is not allowed. So are any sweeteners allowed? Like, are you okay with sugar, adding sugar to food?
No, not really.
Okay.
I mean, dates are really great for sweeteners. You know, date syrup or date, blended dates, date sugar as well as there.
Small amounts of maple syrup might be okay. Depends on what, if someone's finding it really hard to have a particular fruit or like a smoothie or something, but adding a small amount of maple syrup or date syrup or something may help them consume that healthy food, then we think that may be okay. But ideally, you want to avoid as much kind of
refined
sugar or sugary, just plain sugary substances as you can. Eat more foods that are like fruits and fiber filled, rather than foods that are devoid of fiber.
Okay. Processed foods, again, once somebody is healed and feeling well, even if they are vegan, like there's certain vegan chips, cookies, cakes, candies, and crackers that are out there. What are those okay to sometimes have on a occasional basis, or should they be completely eliminated?
That's an interesting question, because I guess those foods aren't healthy. So, on the record, we wouldn't really recommend people eat those foods. But if, as a treat once in a while, you'd probably be okay. You may not feel as good the next day, or you may not feel as good with the digestion, but you're not going to get a, recurrence of symptoms if you have it once in a while. But, if you kind of do the things that got you into trouble in the first place, then there's a chance that your symptoms can come back. So,
This is what I say to people, that for those people that are going through healing and those that want optimal health, if you don't eat a low-fat, whole-food, plant-based diet 90% of the time, then are you further injuring your gut lining, microbiome, endothelium, liver, kidneys, etc.? So the question is, what are your health goals? Are you trying to reverse disease, or are you trying to stay healed? It takes a much higher level of adherence to reverse disease than it does to prevent it. Mm-hmm. So, what do you want?
For me, I
want to basically be in a state of health where I'm not running to the bathroom 24/7. I know what it feels like to be in that condition, and I don't want to be imprisoned to the toilet. I want to have control of my bowels. And so I eat foods that are going to not only help my gut, but help me prevent heart disease, diabetes, some cancers, stroke, Alzheimer's, So that's where I look at it from my perspective, and I think it works really well from what I'm doing at the moment.
And from our experience, Samir, it's just that what we find with our clients is they feel so good as they get past the, once they get through the healing phase onto the post-healing phase, they feel so good, and they really start to enjoy the way that they're eating. So they don't seem to want those foods. Like, no one's really asking me when they heal, how often can I have, deep fried potato chips, or how often can I have cookies, or those kind of things. People aren't asking those kind of questions, I find, and people are realizing, because the whole program is around educating people about how their lifestyle choices affect their health. So once you have the education, you're less likely to make decisions that are going to harm your health.
And to be honest, for some people, it's easier to have zero than to try and work out how little you can have to get away with it.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's up to you.
Someone's been addicted to the wrong types of, these foods, they have drug-like, sensation. If you read The Pleasure Trap by Doug Lyle, they kind of stimulate your body and your receptors, pleasure receptors, in a way that's not really beneficial for you. So, I've kind of stopped certain addictive substances, alcohol, coffee, cheese, dairy, those kind of things that have addictive traits. And so I find that stopping 100% is much easier than, or have a little bit, because once you start having a little bit, then the little bit increases. And then it increases even more, and before you know it, you're kind of back to where you started. So it's kind of sometimes better for people, as Jimmy said, to kind of not go back there and stay with the foods that got them to where they want to be.
Okay. How do you guys do, like, meal prep? That's must be very difficult, time-consuming to continuously eat food from scratch. So oftentimes I see patients who are busy professionals. You know, they have full-time jobs or they have families, like a big many kids to take care of, and sometimes I get resistance to doing dietary changes because of those things. So how do you recommend the busy professional or someone with a busy family life accomplish this?
Yeah, well, follow us on Instagram and you'll see exactly what we do every single day. I mean, this is where what I want to show people is how can you live this lifestyle. And so every single day I will basically show everyone what I eat. And, you know, when you can take ideas from
me. Both of us,
yeah. And to be really honest, this lifestyle is probably one of the easiest ones out there because you don't have to do that much prep.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're making a smoothie, you can take it away, you know, and you can chuck it in the car when you drive to work. So all those things, I mean, obviously when you are going through healing, it may be a little bit more tricky, but if you plan ahead, and that's where we give you that education on that, if you plan ahead, you will be able to start to introduce these things into your life and make it easier for you. Because what we want to do is make it as simple as possible for you. Simple food, simple life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's any more complicated than any other type of diet in terms of preparing or anything like that. It's you know, in fact, you know, because you're eating a decent amount of fruit, there's less cooking, there's less cleanup. You're not using any oil, so things don't stick to the pan. So when you clean them, it's really easy. In fact, you spend less time worrying about food and what to eat and things like that than what we used to do. I don't know how you feel about that, Shan, but it just is so simple, you know, that I find that I spend less time preparing and cleaning up after meals and things than I ever have.
Okay. So, you know, we have a little bit of time left. I'm going to go directly to our questions from our listeners, if you guys are okay with that. So,
sure.
You know, one listener asked, you know, how many patients with IBD, you know, roughly have you consulted with? And have you had patients who did not respond to the diet, which, you know, my opinion is that there's no intervention that's going to help 100% of people. And so, you know, there's definitely people who don't respond to medications, people who don't do a lot with surgery, and, you know, various diets. I've seen many people try them and still require surgery afterwards. So, yeah, how many people have you guided through this?
I'd say over the last 6 years, it's been somewhere, I haven't got the full official numbers in front of me. We would have had somewhere around 400 to 500 clients. I can't tell you exactly how many have healed. The thing is, you got to realize the thing is that some people work with us for 1 month, some people work with us for 3 months, some people work with us 6 months, and you're not necessarily going to get 100% kind of recovery in that kind of time frame. But just I had a doctor ask me this a couple of years ago, and I just took a cross-section of 60 clients just to give you an idea of, I just randomly selected 60 clients, and out of those 60 clients, 10 dropped out of the program, so 10 did not finish.
Okay.
Out of the 50%, and this is only people that did 6 months, so I've dropped out the 1 month or the 3 months, people who did those kind of time frames, so people who did 6 months with us. Out of the 50 people who did the 6 months, 47 people said that they felt better and they got healed. Okay. And 3 didn't within 6 months.
Okay. Yeah, you know, there is this concept in clinical trials called intention to treat analysis, where, you know, when they enroll mainly in drug trials, but is potentially something applicable to interventional dietary studies, but So intention to treat means they include all comers in the analysis, even if somebody drops out due to noncompliance with the diet. And this is the preferred way to analyze data, as it's more accurate in the real-world setting, as opposed to the other way to do it is called per-protocol analysis, where you just include people who complete the whole study design or the dietary intervention. So I can say in my practice, you guys are getting a select group of patients who are contacting you who are interested in diet already. So they're going to be more likely to go through it. And I see all comers, like people who have absolutely no interest in diet, even if they know that it may potentially be helpful. But, you know, I recognize that, you know, there is a subset of patients who are interested, and to hear from your GI, oh, diet has nothing to do with it, I never say that. I say it does have something to do with it. I give them options. I give them options of all the diets, depending on what's more realistic for them to follow, because I believe adherence is more important than necessarily whatever dietary protocol that you choose, because all of them tend to take out processed food. And I would say the vast majority don't end up strictly following a diet. I mean, I give them a handout. I give them all the resources and everything to do. And most of them say, okay, I'll look into it. And then I see them on follow-ups, and they don't, they haven't really changed anything. So I do think you have to be a special kind of bird to want to, you know, do this. And I think it's the more educated patients and the people who know about the downstream effects of these diseases over time and the ones that don't necessarily want to rely completely on medications to maintain their remission. But so it's interesting to hear you've obviously have a lot of experience with implementing this specific diet in hundreds of patients. So would you say that you've seen more success in ulcerative colitis versus Crohn's, or a certain distribution of the inflammation, more small bowel disease, more colonic disease that responds better, or is it all pretty much the same?
It seems to be everything. All the digestive health conditions, whether you've got pancolitis or just proctitis or Crohn's.
I don't think there's one that's better, because we get more people that do have ulcerative colitis because of what I went through. And then there
just before you do that, say that, Sham, you know, so maybe like the difference between the way we work and what you would traditionally work in the medical practice is we're holding these people's hands for 6 months. We speak to them every single week. You know, we're in touch with them, like messaging them in between weekly calls. You know, they're sending us pictures of what they're eating, and we're kind of reacting to this and explain to them, okay, maybe you make this change, make that change. And they're calling us, and they're talking to us about their concerns and how they're struggling with these cravings. And we're helping them talk through those processes, where unfortunately you don't get to do that in the medical setting. You see them once every 3 or 4 months for a short amount of time, which means you don't get the ability to kind of be with them and you know, go through their concerns, or I'm having trouble cooking these kind of things. Maybe there's some other options for me, and I can talk them through that, you know, in real time. So that's why if you look at the adherence, you'll see that there's much more likelihood. Of course, what you mentioned is people, they want to work with us, right? They wouldn't come to us if they hadn't seen what we're about and weren't interested in that. But on top of that, you've got 6 months of weekly half an hour meetings, and sometimes more than that. So there's a lot of it's very intensive. There's a lot of time spent with these people, which you unfortunately can't do in that medical setting.
And not only that, when they first sign up with us, we offer them a free consultation, because I need to know from that person whether they are ready to do this, and I make them aware of certain things that they might go through, and it's this lifestyle change that they are looking for. And many, many of the people that I speak to, I've spoken to over thousands and thousands of people with this free consultation. And every time I speak to them, they're always telling me that, you know, I don't want to be on medication for the rest of my life. You know, I want to live a healthy life without these drugs. And most often than not, people are coming to me because the drugs have not worked. And that's where I think we take them through this lifestyle change and go, look, if you want to heal yourself and if you want to heal your gut, then these are the things that you can do to do that, just like myself and just like so many others have done so. And I think the reason I do that consultation for free is because I need to get to know if that person is ready to begin this new life of theirs. And that's what I love about my job as well, because we see this beautiful change that people are making towards a healthier lifestyle. And this is the base or the foundation of education and lifestyle change that we want to give to people to then apply it to their lives and live a healthy life without, you know, any kind of digestive symptoms. And for most often than not, people you know, don't want to be on medications, and they can have that life as well. So that's the goal for us and for the person that's coming to us as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, listeners know my opinion on this based on what I've said on prior podcasts, but I think the best odds of actually responding to diet is combining it with medication, definitely initially. Mm-hmm. And even you can say that tacrolimus, when you took it, did help to kind of initially stabilize things. And I think when these patients are very sick, especially in the hospital, to expect diet to rapidly, you know, turn them around by itself, is most of the time, in my experience, doesn't work out. But I think when they combine it with medication, and most of the time that happens anyway, they're on some medication. But you're right, like, medication by itself long term doesn't work out for most people. I mean, even if you respond over time, that tends to peter out. Of course, I have patients in my practice who, you know, one comes to mind who's been on Remicade since like 2003 and completely fine and has not had any issues. That's not the usual course. Most people do respond, but tend to lose response over time. But I think that if you follow a diet along with medicine, then, man, you're covering your bases from all perspectives. And now the GI field is starting to turn around as far as this whole concept of de-escalation, of actually stopping biologics. You know, I interviewed Dr. Chiba, and in his protocol of using infliximab and a plant-based diet together, and then eventually maintaining remission just with this plant-based diet. And so he only used 3 infusions of Remicade and then stopped it. Mm-hmm. And even in our most recent American College of Gastroenterology postgraduate course, there was a whole lecture on de-escalation of therapy, of how to actually stop medication and when is it appropriate. And I think, you know, it's kind of dumb, I think, to actually stop medicine without doing anything else. I mean, my approach to this is you have to be on medicine. And for me, it's at least a couple of years, like 1 or 2 years on a dietary regimen. And then you need to have a normal colonoscopy that's, you know, completely normal with normal biopsies. Then we can take you off medicine and then carefully monitor you and see what happens. But it's not 100%. Even some people within that context flare as well. So.
Yeah, and I kind of tend to agree with that. We don't tell anybody to come off their medication without consultation with their doctor. And ideally, we're working together with their medical professional. You know, as their blood tests improve, as their symptoms improve, then they can start to come off. And so many of our clients have been doing that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's the ideal situation. We're working together with the medical professional. And as their numbers improve, the doctor is taking their medications off, you know, mm-hmm. you know, because I can't advise anyone on medication. I'm not trained to do that, you know. So, you know, there are unfortunately some situations where the doctor won't support that. I think that's unfortunate. And then the client ends up making the decision. And I think that's very unfortunate. I think the doctor should be really working with what the client's goals are, and what the client wants to achieve, you know, and give them appropriate timeframes and measures as to what they need to achieve to come off some of that medication. But a lot of our clients, their doctor tells them that, no, I will not support you coming off your medication at any time. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I think that comes from a background of, again, doctors, MDs are very evidence-based driven. So there is no strong evidence base right now for a plant-based diet. I mean, the only thing that's published is what I looked at was a case report that was published of somebody who did well, who was like failing medications, and then this Dr. Jiba case series. But that is considered low quality evidence. It's not a randomized controlled trial. Will one of those eventually come out? Yeah. But, and then when that does, then maybe if it's proven that it's a maintenance strategy that works, then they'll do it. But, you know, in the pharmaceutical industry, is the one funding a lot of these high quality studies, and it's difficult to do a randomized control trial for a dietary study. So that's why it's unfortunate. You're right. I mean, there is this fear that you're going to get sued. Like if I have a patient who's on medication and they're doing well, and then suddenly I'm like, okay, you're on this plant-based diet, we're going to stop your medicine and see how things go. Suddenly they flare. You try to restart the medicine, it doesn't work anymore. Maybe there's some insurance barrier to restarting medicine. Then you're stuck with this patient who's flaring. Eventually, if that patient gets surgery, that patient's going to come back to you and say, doctor, why did you tell me to stop my medicine? I was doing well. And then all of a sudden you got a lawsuit on your hands, and it's not defendable in court because there's no study that's saying what, you know, a plant-based diet compared to Remicade, what has better, higher quality evidence. I'm not saying this is right, but I'm just giving you a peek behind the curtain. This is this is what's up. This is what's going on.
Yeah. Big time. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's, you know, is it a case of, you know, if the client really comes to you saying that, you get them to sign some kind of waiver saying that this is my decision, not the doctor's. I mean, I've had doctors do that with clients.
Yeah.
So, okay, you want to come off your medication? Well, you know, if you want my support, you have to, this is not what I would suggest, but if that's what you want to do, please sign this waiver, you know, releasing me from liability if something happens.
Right.
And you know, I think that, and the client should also be, or the patient should also be aware. We make people aware that, you know, you can sometimes get an increase in symptoms before you improve. You know, like if you look at what happens at True North Health Center or Dr. Goldhammer, they talk about the healing crisis where people get an increase in symptoms before they get better, and we've seen that happen as well. So it does happen that way, where, you know, you can have some increase in symptoms before.
And that's where you need to kind of hold their hand as well and tell them, look, things are going to work out. You know, the evidence suggests, you know, that a plant-based diet is going to, you know, eventually help your microbiome and help your symptoms, so, and lower the inflammation. So, you know, it's that support and guidance that people are after, and that's what we give, that's what we provide. And if people are ready to take on that, you know, we're more than happy to help them.
And we're never going to tell anyone that going through this journey is going to be easy. You know, it's hard.
But, well, lifestyle change is hard, isn't it?
Right. Okay, and, you know, actually a lot of the questions people submitted, I think we answered already. There's, you know, somebody asked about this anti-MAP theory. I did a whole podcast on Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis. They want to know, are you guys familiar with that? And I don't know if there's really a question there, but yeah, I think your diet automatically addresses that problem because it takes out beef and milk. Mm. So, and what about the, let's see, how long do you have to give to see results? How long does it take before someone can notice something? The SCD diet says a month. Give it a month. Any time frame for you?
That's a tough one. I think it really depends, right? Like, if their goal is to be medication free, generally once they, if they've done it safely, they've come off their medications in collaboration with their medical professional, then anywhere between, what do you reckon, Jimmy? Somewhere between 1 and 3 months after they've come off their medication, they'll see
they start to improve. So they get a lot of the symptoms start to get less at around that stage. But then again, it's different for different people in that way, where people have different severity of condition, and that can affect how the
You can't just have it's really difficult to give a kind of time frame because, you know, someone may have had it just been diagnosed a month ago, whereas another person may have had it for 20 years, you know, and been on different medications and had a completely different experience going through their life till now. So, I would say the vast majority of people get better within the 6 months time frame. You know, well over 90% of our clients would get better within the 6 month time frame, but some of them take longer, and we tell people don't have a expectation on how long it's going to take. But if you do the right things, generally over a period of time, you will see improvement.
The time frame for So there's a difference between symptoms and inflammation getting better. We know there's a very, very poor correlation between that, like symptoms, just feeling better and healing when it comes to Crohn's disease specifically. For ulcerative colitis, there may be somewhat of a correlation. Definitely, if you're seeing blood in the stool, you're probably still active. The time frame for actual healing of the colon is, for ulcerative colitis, roughly, and this is for medication, not dietary diet specifically, but for medication is 2 to 4 months. And then for Crohn's disease, more 3 to 6 months. But if you have really deep ulcers, it can be up to a year. I would anticipate, you know, I don't know what the time frame would be if you're using diet by itself. But if anything, I think diet and medicine may boost those, may make it actually a shorter time period. So, you know, that brings us to the, I'll have this to be the last question, because actually many people...
Just before you ask that question to me, like, I've had a lady working with me in Australia who's got Crohn's disease, and she did exactly what you, I think what we consider to be the ideal situation, where she weaned off her medication in collaboration with a doctor. It took her nearly 5 to 6 months to come off all her medication. And now she's been working with me for about 9 months. She's off all her medication. There's no symptoms. She didn't really have any kind of withdrawals, major withdrawals from symptoms. So I think, you know, what you're talking about, where you use diet in collaboration with discussing medication with your doctor, seems to be a really positive way. And then she's totally medication and symptom free right now. She's doing really well.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I love seeing that, you know, seeing people maintaining remission off medication. There seems to be this feeling amongst my profession that we get upset when people are off medication and doing well on diet. Yeah. It makes me very happy that that's the case. And I think we should, that's why part of the reason I'm doing this podcast is to talk to people like Shamiz who have done this, and to see specifically what you're doing and to show that it's possible, because these things can be published in you know, case reports are hard to publish nowadays. Very few journals are accepting them because they consider it, again, low quality evidence. But I think having like an hour conversation with somebody regarding how they did it, I reviewed your records, you know, you have a legit diagnosis of IBD, and you've been doing well for 7+ years off medication, which brings me to the last question. You know, a lot of people asked, oh, are you going to have a colonoscopy? Are you going to have some objective evidence? Because from what you sent me, it was all colonoscopies during that initial hospitalization, right? Like in Japan, which did show some improvement, but not complete, you know, mucosal healing. It didn't show the colon was completely healed. I believe the last scope I saw, there was still some inflammation there. But that's understandable, because if you were only in the hospital for, you said, 5 weeks or so, that's not enough time to completely heal the colon when it comes to ulcerative colitis. So, you know, have you had a colonoscopy since that, in the last 7 years that has shown healing? And is that something that you would be thinking about doing in the future?
Yeah, I have not had a colonoscopy, but I have had regular blood tests and checked by my doctor as well in New Zealand. And, you know, I've actually become quite good friends with my doctor as well. And we go on bike rides together and you know, we do hang out quite often. And so, you know, he sees me and he goes, you know, you seem to be doing really well. And I don't know if I will have a colonoscopy. If my blood test results show any kind of issues, then I may get one. But, you know, my calprotectin as well is doing all right. And I will just keep having regular tests done every year to make sure that my body is in check. And I know how I feel. I feel absolutely amazing every day. And I know what it feels like to be sick in hospital. And my life is nowhere near like that anymore. You know, maybe someday I will have a colonoscopy. Maybe we'll give it 10 years and see.
Okay.
But at the moment, I'm doing really well in my life. And I'm trying to help as many people as I can.
And your doctor's not really recommending that you get one based on how you're feeling.
Yeah.
So you did have a calprotectin. You did have a stool study, and you said that
was... Yes, I've done a stool test, yeah. And that was fine, yeah.
That was normal. Okay. Well, that's objective evidence there, and has pretty good correlation with colonic inflammation. I mean, the last thing that I would say, and then I'll give you guys the final word, is, you know, there are people who do well, symptomatically well, and they're not on medicine, and they, you know, unlike yourself, which I commend you for continuing to follow with your GI, but sometimes people fall off the medical map, and they're not seen for years. You know, one of the things that's recommended, at least according to the U.S. guidelines, is if you've had any type of colitis involving more than a third of your colon for more than 8 years, it is recommended you get a colonoscopy every 1 to 2 years for screening for colon cancer, because there is a slight increased risk of colon cancer. That risk probably isn't high if you've healed your colon, but still a little bit above the baseline risk. Now, how often do people follow those guidelines? In my experience, I mean, actually the majority do, but there are people who say, hey, I don't want to mess with my success. I don't want to get a prep that could potentially, you know, make things worse, although there's no evidence that that happens. So I would say getting a colonoscopy every 1 or 2 years is the medical recommendation now. But obviously, as you guys have said, and even in my practice, the patient is the boss. I can only make recommendations. This is what we're supposed to do. And then if you don't want to be on medication, if you don't want to get scopes, that's obviously nobody is forcing patients to do anything. But I'll give you guys the last word. And thanks for making time on a Monday for this podcast. I think a lot of people will benefit from this information. And then if you can fill people in, how they can find you online and how they can contact you.
Yeah, okay. So thanks so much for having us. We're always wanting to share our story and help people, okay, because that's something that I definitely want to do. When I was in a situation of despair, you know, I didn't have anyone to support me through the process, and that's why we have started High Carb Health, to try and support and guide people the same way that I would have wanted that support when I was very sick. And so people that want to follow us, please obviously go to our website, highcarbhealth.com. Please follow us on Instagram. That's one thing where you will see exactly what I do every single day, whether it's the food that I eat, whether it's the sport that I, or whether it's the running that I do or the mountain biking that I do, and showing you how you can live your life and eat a variety of whole plant foods. So that's another social media tool that we use to show people that you can live without disease. And that's where I want to try and give hope to people out there that are struggling, because there is a way that you can live a really good life, and I am trying to help people and show people that there is that way. So Instagram, Facebook, website, and YouTube, of course. Obviously, I have a YouTube channel. It's called High Carb Health, and you can go and check out some of the stories and some of the people that we have helped. That gives you hope as well, that you can also heal yourself, and you can also you know, live a life free of disease and not be imprisoned to a toilet. I guess that's...
Yeah, so all those social media handles are at High Carb Health. So if you're on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, at High Carb Health, you can find us there. And you know, there's more than 100 success stories on our YouTube channel. So if people want to sit down and watch how people have been able to heal themselves and get better and live life after colitis or Crohn's or other forms of IBD, you can see their stories there.
All right. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thanks, Amir. Thank you. All right, you take care too, mate.